Thank you very much. So I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me an opportunity to sort of start off the usual discussion session by presenting some of our work. I will try and present sort of a nice overview briefly on heavy fermions, superconductivity, before showing some details of my results. Is there a pointer or anything? Yes, that's fine. At least it's low enough so I can just point with my hand. So the stuff I'll be talking about today, so I'd like to thank the group at Los Alamos for educating me on heavy fermions, and in particular point out several people. I'll be presenting work from a lot of different people in our group. Eric Bauer grows the samples, Mark Janicek is our neutron scatterer, Joe Thompson is sort of our senior advisor, scientific leader in the group. There's some work by Tusan Park and his student Soonbom So from Sungkin Kwan University in Korea, who did some pressure work. Philip Moll has done some fabrication with focused ion beam samples of 115s at the ETH and Bertram Batlogs group. Wow, thank you. this will work great. And Hiro Sakai from the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency did some NMR work for us. So as an outline for what I'll present, like I said, I'll start with a sort of heavy fermion primer, and specifically be talking about superconductivity on the border of antiferromagnetism today. Now there's sort of three specific scientific issues that I'll like to address, sort of issues of sort of two different dopings into the 115 family of heavy fermion superconductors, and I'll explain those. As well as then discussion of sort of reduced dimensionality, and then tied in with that is sort of the issues of crossovers between the localization and sort of delocalization of the F electrons, which I think is also relevant in cuprates and perhaps many other unconventional superconductors. And then also I'd like to talk about sort of competing electronic states in general, which in this case we've revealed with the application of high magnetic fields. Okay. So I'm sure many in the audience are much more familiar with heavy fermions even than I. But so the simple description for heavy fermions is that you have a sea of localized moments carrying a magnetic spin embedded in some conduction electrons. And so as you lower the temperature, the conduction electrons are able to screen the local moments, and so you remove the spins from the system. And in a sort of mean field slave boson picture, you can think of a localized F level, which hybridizes weakly with a conduction band going through here. And then you end up with a very flat band. And so that flat band is then responsible for the large effective masses. And so this is primarily the key feature of which gives heavy fermions their great tunability, because you have a very small energy scale in the problem now. So small changes in pressure, chemical composition can dramatically change the ground state of the system.
Just to follow on yesterday and interrupt everywhere.
Please.
It's interesting in this picture that flat band ought to be hellishly sensitive to a field of similar energy.
Yes.
And it's not. Lots of the heavy fermions are very resistant to quite high magnetic fields. Their gamma just sits there and says, I'm not a single particle.
Right.
This much energy.
So sometimes I think the answer is in the G factor, that the effective G factor can be very small. But.
Or it's a many-body correlated effect, and this model is a model.
Yes. Or change of chemical potential proportional to h squared divided by the bandwidth, which is much larger.
Right.
Are you thinking about also the disruption of the quantum effect by the magnetic field?
The thing is, because that's a simplified picture, right? I mean, one should think about quantum ultimately, to some extent, is a resonance scattering.
Right. What I want to point out is that the energy scale that matters, you would think, would be of the order of the quantum temperature. So that's 100 Kelvin, that's 1,000 Tesla, right? sorry, that's about 100 Tesla.
Okay. Some of the Kato temperatures for these things are much smaller. Much smaller. I mean, if you're talking about a gamma of 1,000, it's not a Kato temperature or whatever it was you said. I mean, I'm not talking about gammas of 50. I'm talking about gammas of 1,000, like uranium really 13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're saying, Greg, that it's more than just a factor of pi?
I'm sorry, more than a factor of pi. Is this some literature
factor of order of magnitude? You're saying that there are cases where the field is so large that the Zeeman energy is already more than pi times the Kato temperature?
Yeah.
And it's still, the heavy state is still there?
Yeah, and the gamma more or less is independent of field.
Please give one example, just
uranium, beryllium 13.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's a.
And you're looking in the specific heat or directly in photo emission or what?
Specific heat and field. You put on 20 Tesla and anybody here. Philip, what's the Kato temperature for a gamma of 1,000? 5.
Yeah, 2 Kelvin.
Yeah. So,
but gamma, and then so you're sort of relating a single ion kind of Kato temperature with the gamma.
Yes.
Not necessarily, which perhaps is different from the coherence temperature, but for uranium beryllium 13.
Right? Nobody has solved it.
Yes.
That was the point I was trying to raise. Yeah. It's not a single ion thing.
Exactly.
To be fair, Greg, as you know more than anybody else, uranium systems are more complicated.
Well. Thank you. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good point.
The cerium and ytterbium was, in principle, simple.
Right. This was his primer. I didn't want the people that were being primed on heavy fermions to think that cerium
was a solved problem and we were all done. Okay. So with that disclaimer, I'll proceed. So obviously there's another possibility as opposed to screening the local moments is that the local moments can talk to one another via the conduction electrons. And this leads to the well-known RKKY interaction. And so you can generate long-range magnetic order. So creating a singlet between, some senses between the local spins as opposed to between a local spin and a conduction electron. And so with these two sort of competing effects, you end up with the well-known Doniak diagram, where we have sort of temperature on the vertical axis as a function of the Kato interaction, so the interaction between the local moments and the conduction electron. And the screening of the moments is exponential, and so at low J values, the RKKY interaction wins, you get long-range antiferromagnetic order. And eventually, the Kato scale of the screening wins, and so you suppress the antiferromagnetism to zero. And what is interesting is, at least particularly in cerium compounds, is that we seem to find a dome of superconductivity that surrounds this antiferromagnetic quantum critical point. So with respects to the superconductivity, there are quite a few things that we can notice just in the heat capacity data as a function of temperature. Here for Los Alamos's favorite heavy fermion superconductor is cerium cobalt indium 5. So what you see, for starters, you see a very large Sommerfeld value of the heat capacity. That means a large effective mass. That's exactly to in point with this small energy scale, the fact that the system is highly tunable. Because of this large energy scale, you have a small Fermi temperature. And so TC, which here is only sort of 2 Kelvin, is still very large relative to the Fermi temperature, so very similar to cuprates. In fact, it's one of the things that makes heavy fermions nice model systems for studying superconductivity. There is a very large amount of entropy that goes into the superconducting state that you can see just from the area under the heat capacity curve in the superconducting state, so meaning that the spin fluctuations that were responsible for generating this large effective mass here, the entropy is then released as you enter the superconducting state. Yes?
Can I interrupt for just one second?
Please.
I guess you define TF by just saying that specific heat should be T divided by TF, and this makes TF small because F starts large.
Correct.
But did anyone look at, or anyone was able to measure T cubed term in specific heat to see whether the correction really scales as temperature divided by some low energy scale.
So T cubed term in the normal state?
Yes.
Electronic.
So,
electronic.
How, so?
Yeah, for liquids, the ones that really depends on the ratio of temperature and what you would call Fermi temperature.
So the.
Find the T cube in that. It's upturning.
Upturning, yes, but then the question is T cube divided by what? Divided by the same scale.
On that plot, it's the T squared term, actually, right? Mm-hmm. On that plot, it's the T squared term, it would be. But how would you separate that from the volume?
Well, so, I mean, right, so you could subtract off the phonons, and then maybe see if you have a leftover term. But, I mean, the other experts, experimental experts in the audience can correct me. I'm not, to my knowledge, nobody has actually ever done this. So,
sorry, can I actually ask a question since Radon beryllium 13 came up? So, in general, the fact that in like serum cobalt indium 5 and uranium beryllium 13, there are both situations where you don't quite, if you look at the heat capacity, you don't quite become flat before you go superconducting. Is that true?
They are technically non-Fermi liquid systems, yes.
I mean, at the time you go TC.
There's a 20% increase between 1 Kelvin, where TC is, and T equals 0 to match the entropy in uranium beryllium 13. A 20% increase in gamma, yes.
Right. Okay.
Similar to this, right? In the normal state, you have, this is even bigger, sure.
But if I, but in the field, you're saying they behave very differently.
Yes.
Okay, just clarifying. Okay.
But this is really, I think Philip is going to tell us this is really fluctuation dominated, and it's very field sensitive.
This is very good. I won't talk about this.
Before I look at the specific the heat capacity, and I'm asking the question, do they look similar? And the answer is, if I look above TC, they sort of look similar. They keep going up. Then TC happens. The jump is large. But when I apply the field, very different things happen.
Okay.
Sorry. This not is even, much more coherent than uranium beryllium 13.
Not even.
It has a larger energy scale as far as the coherence temperature, yes, than uranium beryllium 13.
Even
but
to a theorist, do they look similar?
But it has just as much conversation entropy, and the numbers matter here. It's not just the area. The area compared with R log 2 is very important.
Correct.
And R log 2 is about 3, and this area is about. No, R log 2 is about 5, and this area is about 2.
Correct.
So it's about 2/5 of R log 2, this thing.
Yes.
Right. The numbers really do matter here, because that's the amount of the Hilbert space of the spin going into the condensate.
Right.
So back to Ilya. Philip.
Yes.
C over T follows what temperature dependence here?
So it follows us, well, so once you subtract out this phonons, you can get a log T.
Which doesn't have anything to do with uranium beryllium 13, so they're really qualitatively different. Really quantitatively different. And the other thing is, I said gamma went up 20% between TC and T equals 0. And the answer here, Philip, is a factor of 2.
Well, it's roughly a factor of 2. Yeah.
Right. So, not the same.
Just make a remark. I mean, yes. Another way to look at this is you have a very low degeneracy temperature, and the density of states is very temperature dependent. So.
Mm-hmm. Right, so I agree.
I'm not saying that's the right way, but it's another way.
I agree.
Greg, just one question clarification. So, can I say that the area under the blue curve below TC is equal to the area under the blue curve once you suppress it?
That's right. So the total entropy under here is the same as the entropy that you would get if you integrated this. It looks so. Basically, this area has to match this area here.
Right, it's a second order phase
time. Right. So, yeah. Okay, so a couple other points I still wanted to make also on this slide is that so you have unconventional superconductivity as evidenced by nodal quasiparticles. You can see that here in the thermodynamics quite nicely. That's common for a lot of heavy fermion superconductors. And additionally, the point is that these nodal quasi-particles are also heavy, and you can tell that by the slope of this curve, okay? So it's not that you have just a nice, you've completely removed all the electronic correlations when you've entered the superconducting state. Clearly, the quasi-particles are heavy in this case as well. And finally, because of this small energy scale, most likely, you find systems that are superconducting that are stoichiometric, so you don't need doping in order to generate the superconducting state. So you have high purity systems with large mean free pass, even over exceeding a micron. And really, this is one of the advantages of heavy studying heavy fermion systems. Okay. So then to flash the slide, which probably could just consume the rest of my talk, actually, I guess. So the things that actually I didn't plan on talking about is a large variety of heavy fermion systems exist. We heard a very nice talk from Brian yesterday on uranium, ruthenium, two, silicon, two, where superconductivity emerges out of the hidden order state. There are additionally various uranium heavy fermions where superconductivity emerges within or in proximity to a ferromagnetic state. There are also praseodymium systems where issues of quadrupolar fluctuations come into play, something that Brian has also worked a great deal on. One of the early heavy fermion superconductors, uranium platinum 3, with multiple superconducting phases is very interesting. Greg was asking about intertwined orders on Monday. Certainly, even in cerium cobaltium 5, which I will talk about, but I won't talk about this so-called Q phase or purported FFLO phase, there is certainly magnetism as well as D-wave superconductivity coexisting, and so notions of pair density waves are potentially relevant there. There are systems that are non-center symmetric. There are also very interesting issues of the fact that ytterbium systems can be found, but their TC is very low relative to that of the cerium systems, and ytterbium and cerium are nominally electron-hole analogs of one another.
Could you remind us of the TC for that one?
Of the ytterbium is 100 millikelvin, is that correct, Pierce? You probably know it better than the Y-ball.
Y-ball, 80.
80 millikelvin, okay.
And so this system, this phase diagram corresponds to which material?
Sorry, this is cerium cobalt indium 5.
Is the story with FLO phase now settled or it's still a question mark?
It's still a question mark, I think, so. Yeah, so without going into all the detail, I mean, what is certain is that there is magnetism, and so it's not just the pure FFLO scenario. Now, some people, I think, hold a viewpoint that, well, you have the magnetism, we can forget the whole FFLO story and just build something out of strong correlations, magnetism and superconductivity, but other people believe that the FFLO scenario is still relevant.
But what is established is the spatial modulation, is
that the fast thing? And so that is a way of interpreting the neutron scattering results. So in this phase, the latest work by Michelle Kenzelman showed that there's an extreme sensitivity to the field angle, which there is certainly anti-ferromagnetic ordering. So you have different domains, and you populate the different domains with sort of a 0.2 degree sensitivity on the angle. And so that was interpreted as having sort of this pair density wave forming. So, in other words,
spatial modulation.
Spatial modulation.
It doesn't have to be due to pairing channel. It could be just in the.
I mean, so experimentally is a sudden switching of the magnetic domains. Now, so whether that in your mind implies the pair density wave scenario with the spatial modulation that goes with it.
Can I call it this? So by symmetry, if you have antiferromagnetism and if you have superconductivity, you will linearly couple at the Ginzburg Landau level pair density wave at the same wave vector as triplet pair density wave at the same wave vector.
Could be just induced.
Yeah, but so the question only is whether which one is primary, which one is the driver, which one is just parasite. So the fact that it might be there, and then you need to ask whether it's killed by impurities, a field, or whatever, is a difference.
How big is the order of moment of anti-ferromagnetism in this
machine? I think like 4 or something like that.
I think that's correct. It's sizable, yeah. Yes?
Are you planning to talk more about UPT3? Or
no.
Can I ask? No.
So please ask, yes.
I'd just like to know, what's the status about the anti-ferromagnetism in that system?
At 6 Kelvin?
Well,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The very small moment antiferromagnetism, is that established? I once made a comment that this was all taking place in the presence of antiferromagnetism, and a colleague of mine, Goffard, said that data wasn't established.
Colleague wear glasses and answer the name Greg?
So have there been any recent neutron experiments done?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Well, there's a brand new generation of crystals in that system, and you think that would be time to do that work.
Right.
A lot is known, actually. It's very slow fluctuating magnetism, and so if you put
it's
in...
It's not static, for sure.
It's not static, and if you
who
put in...
Who says
if you,
that? Who says that?
And
that goes back to Bob Byers.
The people who have put in, you can add in, I don't know whether it's antimony or something, and you can actually freeze it out and make it become static.
Pierce, I think it's a palladium.
You think it's palladium?
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's
if it's
correct.
Slowly fluctuating, what's our natural explanation for the splitting between the two components of the order parameter in the apex?
So that's not for me to answer.
Okay.
So.
Structural transition?
Yeah, but there's, you don't have the exact well, I mean, latest I read is that it's not known what causes that splitting.
Okay.
There's
right.
two, like...
Right, but what you're hinting at is that at least some literature was suggesting that it's static magnetic moment.
Yeah, that was the original explanation,
yeah,
so that's not there, the natural
explanation
is here, as far as I can see.
Pete, I didn't get the last what was the question?
The natural explanation for the splitting of the two-component order parameter, which leads to the A-phase
yeah.
transition, was the static moment. If the static moment is not there, then you need another explanation.
Yeah, that's a very good point, a very good point.
So fluctuating moment would not do
no.
the job.
I don't think so, no. That's a very interesting point, actually. What's else producing it?
So you're saying, from a theoretical point of view, there is there any other choice besides a static moment?
Well, Catherine is saying there might be a structural anomaly.
Yeah, I just remember reading that in some, you know, paper that talked about the splitting, but you know, but it also admitted that it doesn't know, what, you know, it's not determined what causes the splitting. But you need to break.
So you need some
symmetry
breaking
symmetry
something.
Break, yeah, symmetry breaking field. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. My pleasure. So I can see that I'm not going to get anywhere through my talk. So, but at least maybe we can get through the primer. Yeah, exactly. So this is great. So what I did want to talk about is superconductivity and proximity to antiferromagnetism. And certainly, I'm sure everyone in the audience is very familiar with the phase diagram of the nictides, which has been, I'm sure, heavily discussed already at this workshop. So in the heavy fermions, cerium-based heavy fermions in particular, I would say that these are sort of the perhaps prototypical examples of what cerium-based heavy fermion superconductors look like. And so in particular, temperature is a function of pressure. Here's the phase diagram for cerium-indium-3 at ambient pressure. It's a 10 Kelvin antiferromagnet. And as you apply pressure, you suppress the antiferromagnetism, and you give rise to a dome of superconductivity. And what is particularly nice about the cerium-indium-3 family of materials is that you can introduce what you might normally think of as a spacer layer. So you, in this case, insert rhodium in between layers of cerium-indium-3. And so clearly the structure becomes much more two-dimensional, and so the antiferromagnetism goes down, as you would expect, with reducing the dimensionality. And again, you can apply pressure, suppress the magnetism, and you find, again, a dome of superconductivity, now with TC enhanced to 2 Kelvin, so an order of magnitude increase in the superconducting transition temperature. The other thing that you can do is you can replace rhodium with cobalt, which is nominally isoelectronic, and so it's just a simple chemical pressure type of effect. And so cobalt, having a smaller unit cell than the rhodium analog, actually already sits here sort of at optimal doping in the case of, or optimal pressure, I should say, for cerium cobalt indium 5, and so which is why much of the work has been done on cerium cobalt indium 5, because you don't need 20 kilobars of pressure in order to reach the superconducting state.
Can I ask a tough question?
Please.
In the pnictides, there are these columns where people say, well, these elements should be isoelectronic.
Yes.
And then the band structure guys go up and say, well, no, actually, that's not the case. and Brian, London College, Brian
Cold.
One of his favorite things was, well, silver and gold are isoelectronic, but they are a different color. So when you said it hesitantly, you said supposedly cobalt and rhodium. Do you have more knowledge than that? Hiding something here?
No, I was not trying to hide something. So I believe them to be isoelectronic. You do the band structure. They certainly look like isoelectronic substitutions, especially when you can look at the lanthanum analogs, lanthanum cobalt indium 5, lanthanum rhodium indium 5, the DHVA, the Fermi surfaces look nearly identical. There are some small changes, so it's not just purely a chemical pressure effect. But I think for the most part, that's a fair statement. Okay, and so I think most of these other things I've mentioned, but so what's nice about this system is that, so what we'd like to think about is the proliferation of spin fluctuations as you suppress the antiferromagnetism, and is this responsible for the superconducting state? Yes.
Don't go on.
Nope. Wouldn't think.
About the suggestive comparison on the left and the right.
Yes.
Does the left phase diagram imply that there is no coexistence for sure?
Sorry, no. This is a poor artistic rendering, I would say, then by these authors. There is most definitely magnetic coexistence.
Okay. In both materials?
I'm not sure about cerium indium 3 if they found the microscopic coexistence, because in cerium indium 3, actually this phase boundary becomes first order just before you find the superconductivity. And I'm not sure how representative this drawing is to see if they've seen microscopic coexistence. Here there is most certainly microscopic coexistence. They've seen that with the NMR.
Thank you.
Okay. So just one slide on the potential strength of the spin fluctuations. So this is for cerium cobalt indium 5. I would argue there's similar data for cerium copper 2 silicon 2. And so what you see here is the so-called spin resonance in cerium cobalt indium 5. So the imaginary part of the spin susceptibility is measured by neutron scattering as a function of energy. Here you see the open circles in the normal state, so a very broad spectrum, and as you enter the superconducting state, you see a very large peak, which is analogous to what you see in the high TC cuprates. And so, depending on your point of view, you can interpret this as either evidence that you have D-wave superconductivity, and so the sign-changing order parameter gives you this resonant peak, or you're gapping out the spin fluctuations that exist in the normal state. In either case, so you have a very similar phenomenology. Now you can look at what the total magnetic exchange energy is that you get as you enter the superconducting state. And so that can be written down with this formula here. And while experimentally it's a very challenging process to actually determine precisely what this quantity is, you can still get a reasonable rough estimate. And what you find, or what in particular Chris Stock found, was for cerium cobalt indium 5, you find a change in the magnetic exchange energy a factor of 100 times larger than the condensation energy for the as measured from the heat capacity. So clearly, it's a very large energy scale in the problem. It's almost sort of ridiculously large relative to the condensation energy, in my opinion. You know, in nictides, I think this number is a factor of 7, or sort of cuprates 7 to 10. So now getting up to of order 100, it seems odd to say that the kinetic energy has to be increasing by 99 times the condensation energy in order to get this balance.
So if you take BCS superconducting, you get exactly this, right?
100 times.
Well, if coupling is very small, it can be 10,000 times.
Okay.
Can I just... Yes. Clarify here, if I just compare this with KTC.
Yes.
How big is it? This.
So.
They both from TC, because I don't know what this means when you say 100 times.
So it's 100 times the condensation energy as measured from the heat capacity. So the.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we're looking for, I guess.
So.
Right hand panel.
The The specific heat gives you the condensation entropy, but I guess you multiply that by TC and you get the condensation
energy. Energy, right.
And then you get a thing that's bigger than 100, so to put in numbers, it's 100 TC times a fifth RL2.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Right.
So, I see.
Yes.
Comment, Philip. I think what Chris Stark and et al. Did, the procedure they used
yes.
to extract the exchange energy gain.
Yes.
Well, the formula is in principle correct.
Yep.
I think in practice there's some questions, at least in my mind.
Agreed.
But it doesn't matter whether it's 100. I mean, in serum copper to silicon, for instance,
it's 20.
We looked at this number.
Yeah.
But you end up with a factor of 20. So
that's right.
I think a large ratio is probably the robust statement, whether it's 100 or.
So I agree with you. So if you could manage to get this number down to 10, I wouldn't be shocked. But you know, so you know, factor of 5 difference in this number. I mean, the main issue, as you note right here, is so what do you put in here for this JFQ, right, for serum cobalt-indium 5? And what they did here was they just said, well, it has an antiferromagnetic, the rhodium analog orders antiferromagnetically at 4 Kelvin, so that gives me an estimate for my J, right? And they just assume that it's Q independent in this case. And then the other big factor is that this is measuring, obviously, at just a single Q wave vector, and it assumes that you can do this integral over the entire Brillouin zone based just on this single Q. So there is reason to go back and try and do this more carefully.
Regardless, the conclusion is that there's a lot of kinetic energy loss.
That's correct, yes.
So incubants, remind me, this is incubants from incubants. Here it's commensurate, does it matter?
Crazy resonance because of white one.
Mm-hmm.
It's commensurate. But there's another issue here which is very similar to what you just mentioned.
Yes.
You showed that one half.
Yes.
Additional data show that the peak is not dispersed in the wrong direction. And that was a big problem for carrying computation based on an excitonic resonance, et cetera, et cetera. Then I heard that the data changed and they found some dispersion of the peak along Z direction. This all goes into the formula which is on the board.
Right.
Whether peak dispersions are not made easily change the number by a factor or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, so I agree.
Yeah, but you see, as I said, serum copper to silicon too, the dispersions were seen, especially, and it was the part of the analysis. But you reach a conclusion which is largely the same.
Okay.
But again, condensation energy, and take example of PCS superconductor. Condensation energy is a difference between two huge changes in kinetic energy and potential energy. Both contain vector logarithm. So this is a change of potential energy.
Right.
So it's.
So it's just saying that this.
There's an important point there. In PCS, the log factor is very large.
Yes.
In these systems, the log factor is not very large.
Right,
but
we're not talking about factor of 100 also.
No. So log of, you know, TF, the Fermi energy is about 10 Kelvin, and TC is 2
Kelvin.
Yeah. So you get a log, which is order unity as opposed to the BCS, where
right.
we can talk
since,
more.
No, since you did calculation, maybe you can answer this. Suppose the very simple analysis, just spin fluctuation mediated superconductivity, just calculate.
Weak coupling theory does not work.
Okay,
period.
Okay.
I heard Hirschner talk about this stuff, and I thought he was working with you. And I thought
correct.
The message I got that was that weak coupling theory did work.
It does not, but we.
Okay. let's talk about the technical aspects because I
didn't. No, I don't think he said it.
Okay.
Okay. So that was my primer.
I'm almost done.
Yeah.
I'm just taking some time. I've only heard description. I haven't heard it talk.
Okay. So I'd like to talk a little bit about cadmium versus tin doping in serum cobalt indium 5. Okay. So here's the phase diagram with doping in serum cobalt indium 5, depending on whether you replace with cadmium or tin. So it's at ambient pressure, serum cobalt indium 5 is 2.1 Kelvin. Superconductor, you apply, dope it with tin, and you simply suppress superconductivity, you increase the average hybridization, which can be seen by the increase of the coherence scale from resistivity. And if you put cadmium in, what Zach Fisk showed is that you can induce long-range antiferromagnetic order. So this phase diagram obviously looks very similar to that of the serum rhodium indium 5 under pressure. And so at least globally, it looks like this doping is just acting as chemical pressure. But what I'll show is, in fact, that the details are different. And specifically, I'm going to show some work now done by Hiro Sakai, which is NMR work. And so here we're looking at the indium 1 NMR spectrum. And so what is indium 1? Sorry. So here's the crystal structure again of cerium cobalt indium 5. So here's the cerium planes. The indium 1 site is sitting in the center of the cerium indium planes. So there's also an indium 2 site, but right now we're looking at the indium 1 site. And so what you see immediately from the doping is that, so in pure cerium cobalt indium 5, you have nice single sharp peak. Because of the dopants, they change the local electric field gradients around the various indium nuclei. And so while the bulk of the system still has this dominant spectra, you see sort of satellite lines which appear, and this is a consequence of the doping just changing the local charge environment of the various indium nuclei. And so we can look actually at what the NMR spectra, the spin lattice relaxation rate, looks as a function of these different satellite peaks. And in fact, we find some differences. So in particular, let's look at the cadmium doping first. So what you don't see so well here, so this is 1 over T1T as a function of temperature. Pure cerium cobalt indium 5 are these gray open symbols, which sort of sit right here below the red open symbols. So in fact, that was the first remarkable thing, is that when you measure this cadmium-doped cerium cobalt indium 5 on the main peak, right, which corresponds to the bulk, the data fall right on top of one another until you get to the antiferromagnetic state, and then you have a suppression of the spin lattice relaxation rate. So really, actually, it seems like in the normal state, the bulk of the sample does actually not sense any of the presence of the cadmium doping, this proximity to the antiferromagnetism.
Sir, Philip.
Yes?
0.075, this nominal or actual? Because there is a, right there.
Correct. Normal. So this is, sorry, this will be not, so this is actual in terms of 5 minus x, I believe. Is that true? Sorry, I take that back. So this is nominal, and it was sitting. So it was sitting here, 12.5%. So I think the label is wrong, actually. So I apologize for that. This is a system. Obviously, it clearly becomes antiferromagnetic at around sort of 4 or 5 Kelvin. So
I was just trying to figure out how many. Basically, indiums in the plane, indium ones, have been replaced by cadmium in each plane.
Right.
Because presumably some of the cadmium goes on the indium 2.
That's right. So roughly the statement from the X-ray, the near-edge XAFS results suggest that it's sort of 50-50 in terms of indium 1 and indium 2, although there are 4 times more indium 2 sites than there are indium 1 sites. Yeah. So, but it's still 50. So
let's say one. So one in five, and so I mean, how many cadmiums are there? What is the percentage of cadmium replacing
right.
indium one sites in one plane? That's what I think.
So
I
think it's
one and a half % of indium
yes.
sites are replaced, right?
Right.
That's 5 minus x.
Yes.
So 1.5 percent of indium sites, and you're saying it's 1/5 of that that goes in the plane.
That no, it's 1/2 of that.
No, 1/2 of you. There are 4 indium 2 sites and 1.
No, but the XAF says it preferentially goes in the indium 1 site.
Okay, so half of it. So it's just under 1%.
Yes.
Okay.
So the point being is, where is the actual sort of anti-ferromagnetism that you might expect, or the spin fluctuations associated with driving the system towards the anti-ferromagnetic state? And what we find actually is now that are sitting on these sort of satellite peaks, which are presumably closer to the dopant atoms. And so you see, in fact, that you have a much sort of stronger increase in the spin lattice relaxation rate. So it indicates sort of what you might expect as you drive the system towards a more localized sort of anti-ferromagnetic state. Now, in contrast, when you doped with tin and you sort of pushed yourself away from the anti-ferromagnetism, again, you get sort of an inhomogeneous spectrum, and you get these satellite lines. But now, independent, so when we look at the bulk line, you can see already that this is actually shifted away from that of the cadmium dopant, of the pure serum cobalt indium 5. And there is a slight difference between the satellite line and the main peak, but not nearly as dramatic as in the case of the cadmium doping. And so it really looks like when you put a cadmium impurity into the system, you create sort of a local antiferromagnetic droplet in the system, whereas in the case of tin, you create a much more homogeneous electronic state. And certainly the notion that you have a magnetic droplet is reminiscent of the cuprates with zinc doping, where the zinc localized the magnetic spins in proximity to the dopant atom, which was shown in a variety, both in NMR as well as STM measurements. The difference being here, zinc went directly onto the spin site, so onto the copper site. Here we're doping onto a ligand site, but obviously it's changing the hybridization to the cerium atom sufficiently to create a similar picture.
So in this case, is it the cadmium goes into the
So cadmium goes onto the indium site and presumably creates more local moments on the neighboring cerium sites to where it is. So what are the consequences of this? So what we found was that, or in particular, Tucson Park and his students, Mbamso, found, so now we're looking at cadmium doping serum cobalt indium 5. Temperature is a function of pressure. You can see you start off in an antiferromagnetic state. You suppress the magnetism and you find a dome of superconductivity. But what is striking is that now where this antiferromagnetism is suppressed, you don't see any signatures of sort of the quantum criticality that you were anticipating. And for comparison, so we can look at the cerium rhodium indium 5, right, which is our sort of prototypical system. Here's the antiferromagnetism, here's the dome of superconductivity. This is just sort of a contour plot of the resistivity scaled by the very high pressure regime. You see there's dramatically increased amount of scattering right where the antiferromagnetism is suppressed. That's not the case here when you're looking at the cadmium doped serum cobalt indium 5. So it really suggests that this inhomogeneous electronic state is able to obscure the signatures of the quantum criticality, which we believe is responsible for this big dome of superconductivity. And so we think trying to understand how disorder is playing a role in these superconductors is a very important factor. The other point being is that cadmium is clearly a very weak pair breaker because the value of TC that you get here, 2.1, is still rather large compared with the overall resistivity.
Could also be that superconductivity in this kind of settings is particularly robust.
Yes.
It's probably the same statement. But,
I think it's the same statement, yeah. So I would agree with that. Yes?
So you showed in the previous slide that the spin fluctuations are there, right?
Yes.
And that was in one of our T1 measurements. And in rho, it doesn't show up. So isn't that just telling you that all these fluctuations are at some finite wave vector, which is not contributing to the transport?
So I would interpret it, differently. I guess I would say that the pure serum cobalt indium 5, so the bulk of the system is showing this behavior. The magnetism sort of got tied up into a very small sort of spectral weight. So that's why you don't see the dominant effect, even though this is sort of responsible for the long-range magnetic order. But the divergences in the heat capacity are sort of dominated by this sort of behavior, which is then just being suppressed as you apply pressure.
To what degree, can you go back to the next one? To what degree is this at least metaphorically similar to the pictures? Like you have the phosphorus dope one, where you see the complicated gold wedge,
right,
all these other ones, and I haven't quite seen it. And these other ones are obviously more dirty. I don't understand it.
Right. So what I would like to argue is that the phosphorus doping is a more homogeneous, sort of uniform electronic tuning, whereas perhaps cobalt doping is more inhomogeneous and perhaps makes observing the quantum critical signatures more difficult, certainly via transport.
It would sort of be inclined to think that this order can be fairly relevant, that these complicated points can take over, and transport is extremely sensitive to disorder, and perhaps, you know, that dirt physics can really completely shroud the quantum color.
Yes, that's what I would like to say. Sorry. Yes?
You just told me that scandium induces antiferromagnetic droplets.
Yes.
So why should I even think about it as a pair breaker? Shouldn't I think that my superconductivity leads away from those antiferromagnetic droplets, and therefore cadmium basically has very little effect on this? And that's why they have the extended thing with TC. So what do I care about cadmium as a pair breaker if it lives in its own antiferromagnetic bubble?
Except,
which is big enough, and therefore it's very weakly.
Except that it's able to generate long-range antiferromagnetic order over the entirety of the sample. So I have a little bit difficulty in trying to explain this, put into words.
The bubbles have to walk phases.
The bubbles eventually have to, generate long-range order, but still, so once you suppress the magnetism, the superconductivity is robust. Maybe it's for exactly what you said. Once the sort of correlation length of the bubble is small enough, then it can just sort of be its own little bubble and sort of you can forget about it. That might be the answer.
And this is true at the ferromagnetism. There is no glassy dynamics related to the bubbles and nothing like that. Like NMR, depending on frequency, has it been done in that phase? Do we know that the peaks don't?
T1 is not frequency dependent. Has not been done, but we've not seen any evidence for any sort of glassy behavior. But it's a good question. Yes.
There is a blue region where we have blue here in here, right?
Sorry, no, this is not a plot of the exponent. This is just the magnitude of these resistivity. So it does become more Fermi liquid out here. It is the non-Fermi. Yeah, sorry.
Has anybody looked at the specific heat?
Yes, so we did specific heat under pressure. It's completely flat here. There's no this log T divergence that was in pure serum cobalt 95 is just not present at all in the system.
Kind of a bit like the pictures, actually. You see the phosphorus dope and nice mass enhancements happening.
Yep.
It was completely weird.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the NMR relaxation rate, for instance, versus capture is most in your NDI there?
So under pressure on the cadmium doped, has not been done on the satellite lines, so it's just been done on the main lines. The T1 sort of just does come down as a function of pressure, as it does in pure serum cobaltium 5. It looks very similar. So the main line basically looks like pure serum cobaltium 5.
So it's not from critical reactor at maximum
TC pressure. Correct. Well, there are two things to disentangle. So as you increase the pressure, the overall hybridization scale increases, so T star increases. I think this has a net sort of reduction of 1 over T1. But in addition to that, there are presumably the quantum critical fluctuations associated with the long-range magnetic order. I think there's some challenge in disentangling that. The dominant effect seems to be the overall suppression as the overall Kondo scale increases.
T to the quarter.
Yes.
Behavior that was seen.
Correct. That
it's not no longer seen here.
It is suppressed. Yeah. It becomes more T to the, I forget, 1/2 or something. It starts going back towards Karinga-like behavior. Yes.
So you said the specific heat under pressure was flat with 1% cadmium doping.
Yes.
Okay. And in above the antiferromagnetic order at zero pressure.
Above the So you see, obviously you see the antiferromagnetic order. You see some increase as you approach that. So it, but it is not. So it, I mean, it looks similar to like what you would kind of expect, right? So you have the log T specific heat, and now you have magnetic order. So it comes up and sort of orders. So as you apply pressure, this thing just sort of flattens out.
Okay.
It's not that you sort of just suppress this thing and stay with the log T behavior.
Right, right. So the effect of the impurity is actually quite similar, right? So 1% impurity is very little, and it's completely changing the general properties of the system. Now, I guess there's a question, when you further dilute it, at what point do you start to see again the physics of the clean limit? What can you do experimentally?
Further dilute it. So even
go 0.001
or something like this. So we have not done that with the exception of studying this FFLO possible phase. Yeah. That's the only time where the very dilute.
Well, basically, you can do it. I see.
Yes.
At what point impurity starts to lose control? We have like staggering that 1% of impurity,
right,
is sitting there at like
right, is obscuring and everything.
Can cause these enormous changes.
I'd like to interrupt just for a second.
Please.
Obviously, we're having a great discussion, and I'm inclined to continue. But
I agree.
In case there are people who had specific presentations they wanted to make during the discussion, can you let us know now so we reserve time for that?
Is Sri here? I'm aware of three short presentations, one by Brian Maple, and one by Greg. And in principle, I can or probably not.
So,
right. Okay,
so
how
will you
try to finish
in
20 minutes or so?
Sure.
And I don't need any time. I mean, Philip's already shown my.
No, no, but it's good to have a discussion with special connection
with Nick. But, you know, the thing I might say is there lunch involved in today's
schedule? That's an hour or longer from now.
From now.
So, carry on.
Okay, so I will at least try and just maybe then highlight one or two slides of the main results. And so, so this is pretty much all I wanted to say about the doping. So, so tin doped in serum rhodium indium 5. So, assuming that tin is also homogeneous in serum rhodium indium 5, what you see here is that. So you suppress the antiferromagnetism with tin doping. You get still the dome of superconductivity as a function of pressure. But now when you look at sort of for signatures of quantum criticality at the suppression of the antiferromagnetism, they remain. And so this is, sort of consistent with this result from the NMR that you have a much more homogeneous electronic state. And so what do I mean by it's consistent? You sort of have a significant enhancement of the A coefficient of the T squared resistivity as you approach this antiferromagnetic quantum critical point, and you see some nice, you see sublinear resistivity and the temperature dependence for the resistivity. Heat capacity under pressure is work in progress and will hopefully show a more divergent behavior in this tin doped serum rhodium indium 5.
You say it's also pair breaking. I said we're just arguing that ketamine is not that pair breaking at all, and tin is.
Yeah, so I would make the argument actually that TC as a function of the scattering rate, where now the scattering rate is just measured by the resistivity. So obviously there's some caveats in trying to generate a scattering rate here, but so what you see is that for cadmium doping actually that TC is quite insensitive, and in this case this was a study done on serum cobalt indium 5. Where tin dopant is significantly more pair breaking than in the case of the cadmium, and which is a question actually. So is the fact that the inhomogeneous dopant less pair breaking than the homogeneous one actually something that in general you would like to?
And I mean, what I'm reading in it is that cadmium completely upsets the normal state, tin doesn't.
Yes.
Right, and then you look at the pairing and sort of way around. In other words. All the conventional rules of pair breaking don't apply here. Something weird is going on there.
It's pair weakening rather than pair breaking, is what you're saying, right?
No, it's no, you know, usual physics, because in a normal state, gets hit hard by an impurity, but you expect it as a polluting state, thinks about it like pair breaking. Mm-hmm. And exactly reverse.
Okay. Yep. So, yes, I would agree with that. So, you know, as an experimentalist, it would be nice to have guidance then as to sort of have some sense as to which dopants should be sort of the stronger pair breakers. And perhaps the question then is there something about the filled shell of cadmium, sort of, you know, cadmium or zinc or something like this, that is actually good in this regard to this system, or that's just a specific to the serum collodion 5 system? You know, people, maybe somebody in the audience has some thoughts as to if there are some general statements that can be made.
There's an old folklore in heavy pyramids, which is dope on the non-F electron side, you suppress TC rapidly, but dope on the F electron side, you suppress TC very lightly. Does this follow that rule? Seems to me that the mercury, the doping with mercury goes onto the cobalt side, it comes down very rapidly. So that maybe isn't the same.
Mercury is also going on the indium side, but you're saying dope on the cerium side.
It should go, according to that dictate,
yes.
It should go down very lightly if you dope on the cerium side and very rapidly on the indium side.
If you do lanthanum.
So you can do lanthanum doping precisely, and so TC persists out to about sort of 15% doping, as I recall. Brian might remember the number. So it's fairly robust. I would say TC is suppressed a bit more quickly in the lanthanum doping than in cadmium doping or tin doping. And so
more quickly.
It is suppressed more quickly. Yes.
Even though you can get out to 15%.
Right, but if you compare it with the residual resistivity increase that you get.
So doing it as a percentage,
yes,
it's less, but doing it as a resistivity
right.
vector, it's about the same or even more.
I think, yes, so, that's correct. Right.
But 15%, I need to compare in this with 0.75 cadmium, right? Or something, or even more, depending on where, if it goes into play. Right.
So it's 15% versus, yeah. Like, so as Pierce was saying, just a few percent here of cadmium.
To compare apples to apples, 15. Yeah. If you replace 15% of cerium,
just
you
remind
replace
you.
Like huge amount of indium with cadmium.
Yeah.
To get the 15% in the plane.
Right, but I mean, we also haven't suppressed it all the way to zero in this case, right? I mean, so
nothing.
So, well, I think probably, percent. Yeah, I think probably Philip. Can continue.
I can move on. Okay. So let's see. So I think, yes, the other, I think, big issue that certainly I would like to talk about is dimensionality. And so this issue of localization, delocalization is tied up with this issue of dimensionality in the heavy fermion superconductors. And certainly localization, delocalization is an issue in cuprates. And issues of how charge degrees of freedom also influence superconductivity is relevant in nictides as well. There are certainly debates about certain pneumatic order. However, we won't be talking about any kinds of pneumatic order in the 115s. Okay, so going on back to this phase diagram for the 115s, it also turns out that you can make an even more two-dimensional structure by having two units of transition metal, in this case platinum, in between your cerium indium 3 layers. So certainly structurally, the system is more two-dimensional. However, you find some surprises. So namely, that the antiferromagnetism is actually at a larger temperature, and TC is slightly lower. So the notion that sort of reduced dimensionality is good for superconductivity, that didn't work, but even almost more strikingly is that the magnetism also went up, because we thought we at least understood magnetism, even if we don't understand superconductivity. So it leads to the suggestion that maybe actually this order is incorrect. So why do I want to now talk about the charge degrees of freedom here? So let's look at cerium rhodium indium 5, and a very important observation is that as you apply a magnetic field, suppress the superconductivity, you can see the antiferromagnetism in pink and the paramagnetic state in blue at high fields. And then quantum oscillation measurements were done by Shishido and Onuki. And what they saw was that at low pressures, you have a small Fermi surface, meaning that the F electron is not incorporated into the Fermi C. You really sort of have nice localized moments. But precisely when you get to this point where the antiferromagnetism disappears, the frequencies jump. The Fermi surface now looks comparable to cerium cobalt indium 5, where now the F electron, the hybridization of the F electron is incorporated into the Fermi C, and you end up with a large Fermi surface. So in addition to this assumption that we always had these spin fluctuations emerging here, we also have to somehow grapple with the issue that the charge degrees of freedom are changing, and specifically that the Fermi surface is changing volume precisely at the same point. And the role that this might have for superconductivity is very unclear. Okay. So can you separate the spin and charge criticality? So now we're coming to this more two-dimensional version, and we have some indirect evidence. Now, so again, this is an NMR measurement, which is looking at the size of the magnetic moment as a function of pressure. So this is size of magnetic moment as a function of pressure. You can see the phase diagram up here. And what you see is that as you, just before you get to the onset of superconductivity, the size of the magnetic moment collapses dramatically. Okay, and so while this is very indirect, what we'd like to suggest is actually that this is more like itinerant magnetism. So in fact, that perhaps you have a large Fermi surface, but the system is still antiferromagnetic. So you start off, presumably, what we know from DHVA measurements at ambient pressure is that you have a small antiferromagnetic state with a small Fermi surface. But now still an antiferromagnetic state with a large Fermi surface, and finally a paramagnetic state with a large Fermi surface once you suppress the antiferromagnetism.
What is plotted on the vertical axis here?
This here is just the internal magnetic field as probed by the NMR.
So the splitting of
this is the splitting of the lines, yes. Okay. And so to try and put this perhaps into a generalized phase diagram, which has been promoted by our organizers here, you can see that you have a measure of some Kondo coupling and some degree of sort of quantum fluctuations, the amount of quantum fluctuations that you have in the system. You have P is paramagnetic, AF is antiferromagnetic, and you have either a small or a large Fermi surface. So the phase boundaries at which these sort of crossovers can occur changes a degree of the amount of quantum fluctuations you have. And so what this suggests is perhaps that, in fact, the 115 material, where the crossover between small and large Fermi surface happened at the same point where magnetism was suppressed, causes it to lie here, whereas cerium platinum 2 indium 7, where we were able to separate the crossover from small to large and the crossover from magnetism to paramagnetic, puts 127 here, which is again now sort of stating that there are less quantum fluctuations, even though this is a more 2D material in the cerium platinum 2 indium 7.
For orientation.
Yes.
Silk question also shows similar data. Is it all the same or?
Yes. So Joe, so if Joe was showing this, then yeah. So this is cerium platinum. We're working together with Hiroshi. Yeah.
This is just the evidence for it.
Yes.
And the collapse of the moment is related to conclusion about the size of the Fermi surface.
It is speculating on assuming that you're going from localized sort of magnetism, RKKY, to sort of more itinerant like, and therefore it's a large.
That's the only argument.
That's the only argument. That, so this is pure speculation that this is what the Fermi surface, because we're only looking at.
Is there any chance that quantum oscillations measurement will be done?
Yeah, same question. So we have tried. So the somehow as you apply pressure, the frequencies just disappear completely. So we are not able to, we have not successfully tracked the frequencies yet as a function of pressure. That is something high on our list that we would like to try and do. We've tried both the HVA and Shubnikov-Tahas. So far it's been unsuccessful. Yes?
So as a quote, I was just looking at my notes from Joe Thompson's talk. So he seemed to have implied that at 45 Tesla there is a transition as a function of field from localized to itinerant Fermi surface.
So as a function of field?
Correct. So in the HVA. So the statement would be, I understand this is a function.
So 45, yes.
Right, but what the statement that Joe made, I think if I'm going to try it, was that if you measure it as a function of field, you see very similar stories in cerium rhodium indium 5. there is a critical field where you see a discontinuity in the lines, and it's so bad that you actually maybe we should go down signal. It was very, very clear.
Yeah, it's true. I think, so the behavior with magnetic fields, and hopefully I'll have a chance to show at least one slide on that, I think is qualitatively sort of different than what's going on with pressure. I think we should be a little bit careful about trying to sort of map exactly what we see here as a function of pressure as to what's going on with a function of as a function of field. But so yes, there are interesting things of when the magnetism is suppressed and where the Fermi surface, where the DHVA shows change in frequency, which is within the antiferromagnetic state, certainly in 115.
Not in this material here.
In this material, no. This in the 127, it looks much more like sort of the cerium indium 3 sort of data that were measured by Neil Harrison. Okay. So one evidence now for the degree of frustration that perhaps is present in cerium. So an answer for why actually cerium rhodium indium 5 has more sort of 2D character than cerium platinum 2 indium 7 is in fact that perhaps you have a more frustrated magnetic exchange interaction along the C direction. And so this is some great work that was done by Mark Janicek and Pinaki Das, where he was able to measure the spin waves in cerium rhodium indium 5 along three different directions in reciprocal space. And then fit this to sort of a Heisenberg, or not a Heisenberg, this is in this case an XY or anisotropic Heisenberg spin model with an in-plane near-neighbor interaction, which is roughly 0.4 MeV, so that corresponds well with the magnetic ordering temperature of 4 Kelvin. And then you have a frustration between near-neighbor and next-near-neighbor interactions along the C direction. You need this in order to get the incommensurate wave vector, which you can see here along half L. So you have an incommensurate wave vector at 0.297. So you need this frustration in order to generate this. The other thing is the spins are known to lie in the plane. So you have actually a spin spiral in the system. And so one of the mysteries with this neutron data is in fact that you have a spin gap, which you can see sort of a suppression of intensity here before sort of the minimum excitation. You can't quite see it so well in this image plot, but it's there also if you do a scan as a function of energy. And so the presence of the spin gap is inconsistent with the fact that you should have a Goldstone mode for a spin spiral system. So it is possible that the spin structure has been incorrectly determined. However, the NMR says is certainly fixed in saying that the spins are lying in the plane. It's incommensurate, so it could be amplitude modulated or spin modulated. But the data suggests that it is much better, has better agreement with the spin spiral than with an amplitude modulated system. Yes. So
would anisotropy, unicrystal field splitting, automatically gap out the translational Goldstone modes of a spin spiral? I mean, those modes come from either rotating or sliding.
Right. So then you would have harmonics because so if you had this,
so it wouldn't have a true Goldstone mode then, right?
Right, and you would so the spin structure would not be a pure spin spiral, right? So if you have a pure spin spiral, there is still a Goldstone mode associated with
no,
that pure spin.
No, because you wouldn't know that you would even if it were a perfect spin spiral.
Yes.
The cost of translating it by a small amount would. There would be a cost for translating it by an infinitesimal amount.
Because not along the Z direction.
Along the C direction.
Pure translation.
Oh, I see. It's along the C direction.
Completely fixed.
No, but even there, you have a fourfold symmetry rather than a perfect rotational symmetry. So as I translate it a little bit along the C direction, I rotate the thing.
Yes.
But infinitesimal rotations cost energy in a fourfold symmetric environment. Only 90-degree rotations cost no energy. And so I think
I would like to talk to you about
this. So I think it has to be gapped out due to they haven't. Whoever did the calculation needs to learn about crystal fields.
There's icing and isotropy here, so
doesn't matter. It's got four-fold symmetry,
which could go along
as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but I should also give credit to Shizeng Lin, perhaps. Now you're saying that I shouldn't give credit, but so for the theoretical calculation that was able to model the data actually quite accurately. So using this sort of three-neighbor interaction.
Just to finish off, yes. The point is there are terms like J plus to the fourth power in the Hamiltonian, necessarily, and J minus to the fourth power, which add and subtract 4 units of angular momentum. When you project those into this spin fluctuation manifold, you'll find that it gaps out the continuous rotations around the z-axis.
So my understanding was that should generate harmonics in the sort of the Bragg scattering, so you should be able to see the intensity of the higher harmonics, which are just
very obscured.
Well, which we're not seeing.
Right,
okay.
Higher harmonics meaning different Q vectors.
Yes.
Sorry, there is a spin gap in the theory. So where does it come from in the theory?
Right.
This was just added. So added ad hoc. Sorry, there should be a plus delta spin gap. Sorry, I've left that out.
But experimentally, yes. So are you suggesting that there shouldn't be any Goldstone laws?
There shouldn't be a Goldstone law,
even though it's long-range order?
Because it doesn't have continuous... If spin were decoupled from the real world, then of course it would. But spin is viciously coupled to the real world by spin-orbit coupling. Yeah. And in a four-forward symmetric environment, that means angular momentum along the c-axis is only defined mod 4. Right?
Yes.
So what do we know about direction of the spin in Kapanov-Dove?
Because you know, in the Q phase, the spins are along the C axis. Here, the spins are in the plane.
Right.
So the question is, what do we know about Kapanov-Dove coupled spin direction?
I don't remember. But I know the wave vector is half-half-half, yeah, so it's commensurate. But I don't know where the spins lie.
Just curious where close to.
Yes.
Continue.
Okay, so I think the last thing I wanted to show was sort of the issue of competing phases. And in particular now, there's a lot of interest in the fact that in the cuprate phase diagram, there's a field-induced density wave that is observed in the underdoped regime. And this is a consequence of just perhaps the generic competing interactions that exist. This is the slide that I'd like to show now, that in cerium rhodium indium 5 in an applied magnetic field, we also have a density wave in the system, and I think so bears some analogy to the cuprates. So here's the phase diagram, now plotted slightly different temperature as a function of pressure. So here's our dome of superconductivity. We take cerium rhodium indium 5, we apply magnetic field close to the c-axis in this case. And we see observation of a density wave. In particular, so you see a clear first-order transition with strong hysteresis in the resistivity around 30 tesla. And what you notice is that when you sit on the lower branch, you have nice ohmic-like behavior in your transport, whereas when you sit here, actually, on the return branch in the high-field state, you have a nonlinear IV curve, which is exactly sort of what is the signature for sliding density waves, either spin density wave or charge density waves. And in fact, we have a critical current here for being able to start pushing the density wave, which is comparable to that which you would see in like niobium and diselenide. And so the signature for this feature is not show up in the magnetization, which is kind of striking, independent of whether you want to call it a spin or a charge density wave. But this is sort of the first example of sort of sliding density wave that's been seen in certainly the 115s or any heavy fermion. So,
Cox is with anti-ferromagnetic, right?
This is within, it stays within the anti-ferromagnetic state. So that's a distinct difference from in the cuprates, yes.
Yeah, no, I don't know, because in the lanthanum, the 204 system, right, these things occurred in 1995, they're called stripes.
Yes.
Right, and the mystery is a bit that anti-ferromagnetism has disappeared in the 123.
Yeah.
Right, so the anti-ferromagnet is incommensurate, right? You said it's the same.
This anti-ferromagnet is incommensurate, yes.
And I guess you have no information yet whether the ordinary wave factors of the anti-ferromagnet and the density wave are locked together or not.
Yeah.
That's the same question. Normally, incommensurate anti-particle generally produces incommensurate charge modulation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So by itself, it's not surprising that there should be charge modulation.
But okay. Why would it help in a particular field, only about a particular field?
This is the question.
Good
whether
question.
It's seen only in a particular field range and exists everywhere, just enhanced, or it's just some totally different phenomenon.
Well, I mean, it certainly clearly onsets as you go through here, right? So, yes,
these
but
points HC at different temperatures?
Here? Yes.
Yeah, so these are all from the opening of the
that's from, yes. That's right, and seeing a discontinuity in the resistivity. Oh,
that's pretty vertical.
So, I'm sorry, yes. This looks all like, what was it, niobium selenide?
Sorry, the value of the critical current is niobium selenide. Yes, the sort of classic charge density wave systems.
And X-rays or anything?
30 Tesla has not been done.
But it's doable.
So, is it? Where?
Tallahassee.
Tallahassee has X-rays at 30 Tesla?
Well, just have them roll the machine up and point it down.
Okay.
You know that they're a bit more cuprate superconductors about to work, right?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. So that would be interesting. So for starters, you know, also doing some NMR work, might be a nice local probe.
And so, that's a sharp way to state it. Spin densities also slide, and spin densities are just antiferromagnets. Magnets. Right? When they're incommensurate, they slide. However, they only slide when they're actually in amplitude modulation of the spin, right?
I see.
And when they're purely spiraling, and there's an amplitude out there, you cannot make them slide. So perhaps it's sort of a thing that the incommensurate antiferromagnet goes from being just a spiraling type of thing into a thing that also requires an amplitude modulation, and then it's, as Andre already emphasized, indistinguishable from a charge density wave. But that's perhaps a thing to look for.
Okay, thank you. So I think I should stop.
I
would be gladly done. Yeah.
Okay.
No, these were the new things I wanted to show. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.